This episode of On the Media is supported by Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of On the Media, NPR, and other shows while on the go without downloading or syncing with Stitcher Smart Radio. Thousands of popular podcasts and programs are available on demand. Stitcher instantly delivers new episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone without syncing or downloading. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/media.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. On April 20th, the PlayStation Network, the online service that allows PlayStation owners to play games online, purchase content, and stream movies and audio, suddenly went dark. On April 22nd, Sony, the company behind PlayStation, issued a statement explaining that the outage was due to a, quote, external intrusion by hackers. Gaming and tech blogs took notice, but the story was largely ignored by the mainstream press. At least, that is, until this past Tuesday, when in a blog post, Sony told its 77 million worldwide PlayStation Network customers that because of the attack on its network, their names, birth dates, home addresses, email addresses, and credit card data could be at risk. Additionally, the PlayStation Network, a core component of the PlayStation's functionality, remains offline, with Sony saying it is hoping that it will be back up by Tuesday, May 3rd, almost 2 weeks after the initial attack. Nick Bilton, lead technology writer for the Bits blog at the New York Times, says this is just the latest and by far the largest in a growing trend of personal information making its way out of online entities that we trust and into the hands of, well, who knows? Nick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk about what's at stake here. Having your credit card in the hands of some hacker is one obvious one. Another is passwords. Has that number of passwords ever fallen into the wrong hands before?
Well, there's been a number of recent cases of hackers gaining access to companies and servers and so on. Last month, there was Epsilon, which is a marketing company which stores hundreds of millions of email addresses and in some instances passwords and so on, that was breached, and the hackers got a hold of all of this information. A couple of months ago, the AT&T servers had a problem when someone gained access to the iPads and figured out people's email addresses and a number that identifies the iPad. But this is the first time that something this huge has happened to Sony or a company similar to this, where they've actually said that passwords and email addresses and addresses and so on were taken.
Do you know who the suspects are in this episode?
We really don't. I've written a lot about hackers in the past for The Times, and there's several groups of hackers. There's a group called Black Hats, which are essentially people that are really taking people's personal information and using them to make money. And then there's a group called the White Hats, and they're the ones that try to stop these villains, quote-unquote, and really try to help people protect their networks. But what's happened over the past couple of years is there's a group in the middle called Gray Hats, and they are essentially just out to cause trouble. And they're people that will bring down a website, or they will steal passwords and throw them in the garbage, or whatever it is that they want to do to infiltrate a company. We don't know if the motives behind this hacking with PlayStation was people that were actually trying to make money on these credit cards and so on, or if it was people that were just trying to bring the network down because they don't like the company.
It took Sony almost a week before it informed the world of the scale and the scope of the breach. Why so long? Do you have any idea?
It's a really interesting question, and it's a problem that we've seen happen over and over. Part of this is that there is no federal law that says these companies have to divulge information straight away. There are state laws that say that they have up to a week to notify customers when their personal information is taken. Sony says that it took them 7 days to respond because they didn't really know the extent of what had happened. There are a lot of people that say, hey, you probably knew immediately that the network had been infiltrated and you had a responsibility to let consumers know straight away. As these cases keep coming up more and more, I think we're going to have to see some kind of federal law that is put into place that actually changes the policies so people know straight away if their credit card information or their home address has been taken.
So what happens next?
Sony is working with the FBI in San Diego, the Cyber Crimes Division, to try to determine who it was that got into the system. They're also working with some outside security companies to try to fix the problem and get it back online as soon as possible. A lot of people are now looking on these underground networks where credit card information and personal identification information is sold between hackers.
I have to say I'm stunned that the passwords in the system at Sony were not encrypted to protect against this very sort of breach. Do you foresee much more stringent regulations about how companies must treat personal information within their own servers?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, I think that right now there are no repercussions for these companies. So, you know, Sony will probably get sued by some customers and they'll settle out of court. But other than that, no one's going to get in any kind of trouble. And I think that that has to change. Every week there's a new story in the media that talks about a website that was hacked or people's passwords that were taken. As we divulge more and more information to sites in exchange for use of them, there's a bill going forward right now from Senator Kerry and Senator McCain that's called the Privacy Act, and that is really trying to give people the option to be on a do not track list and to have more control over their content on social media websites. But it really does not include anything about location tracking or the kind of password breaches or security breaches that take place on these companies on a regular basis.
All right, Nick. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nick Bilton writes for the Bits blog at the New York Times. Bilton mentioned location tracking. Now, there's an issue that's au courant.
Yeah, Apple stuff's pretty neat, all right. I just don't want any big company tracking where I am at all times.
Ah, that's just a rumor. They don't really track you.
Here he is. Hello, Kyle. We're from Apple. We're all ready for you now.
What? Ready for what?
To fulfill the agreement. Can we get a weight, please?
83 pounds, sir.
What agreement?
83 pounds, good. Let's get the blood work.
Hey, you can't do that.
You agreed we could take all the blood we needed.
What are you talking about?
When you downloaded the last iTunes update, a window on your screen popped up and asked you if you agreed to our terms and conditions. You clicked agree. All right, let's get him to the water tank.
The water tank? I'm not going with you.
You've agreed to all of this.
That was the TV show South Park, satirizing the revelation last week that Apple iPhones store data about their users' location, data that remains on the phones indefinitely, something that iPhone users unknowingly sign up for. That means that if you bought an iPhone after July 2008, anyone can plug your phone into a computer and, with a program that's free online, see a map of everywhere you've been. Wired's Brian Chen explains how this works and why companies like Apple collect that information.
Every time you're taking out your iPhone and you're using a location service, you are collecting information about nearby Wi-Fi access points and also cell phone towers. And you're storing that information inside your phone. Every 12 hours, you collect all this information and you send it as a batch to Apple. Apple collects this information as a comprehensive location database. They're saying, if you want to locate where you are, first you're pulling information from their database, and then you're using the GPS chip. With just the GPS chip alone, it would take several minutes just to get your location.
However, this data, once it's gone to Apple, just stays on my cell phone, and that creates a security risk, does it not?
Yes, this is the root of the issue that's been talked about since last week. The fact that this information stays on your phone after it's transmitted to Apple, it has no reason to be there. It's not providing you a service once it stays on your phone. Like, say, for example, I went to Vegas in January. That information right now does not help me in any way today. So Apple said it was a bug, and they're going to be fixing that in the next software update.
The story broke, and some people paid very close attention. For example, Senator Al Franken paid attention and announced an intention to hold a hearing on mobile privacy.
I think the issue right now is that this entire geo-collection method wouldn't have snowballed so much if Apple had been transparent from the start. When I use my iPhone, I turn on location-based services. There's no message indicating that I'm collecting information about nearby cell towers and Wi-Fi access points, and I'm storing it and giving it to Apple. Apple's going to need to figure out how they can communicate that more clearly in the future, I think. Something that I think people in Congress want, definitely, is just enabling people not only to know this information, but also to be able to turn it off.
Seems to me iPhone ownership is not just a customer base. It's on the verge of being a cult. And I was struck by the fact that when this security risk was identified, It didn't seem to upset many people besides Al Franken. Did it strike you that there was a kind of muted response to this episode?
I find that a lot of iPhone customers are already sharing a lot of information about things like where they are, what they're doing, what they're eating. To a lot of people, having a trail of what you've been doing for the past year, it wasn't really an issue for them. They weren't sensitive to things like being stalked or being robbed. But Apple admitted that this was a bug, that it should not have been stored this way. And if we're just to be apathetic about these sorts of issues, then these problems are never going to be corrected. So it's good that people in Congress, people in the Senate are trying to take action and demand more transparency from Apple, because if we just sit around, then these problems are just never going to be solved.
All right, Brian. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
Brian Chen writes for Wired magazine. His book, Always On, about our always connected mobile future, comes out in June.
Basically, what this committee is about is making sure that our privacy laws keep pace with technology.
Senator Al Franken is chairman of the Judiciary Subcommittee for Privacy, Technology, and the Law.
There have been some issues of late. The Apple thing is just the latest of mobile devices and privacy.
There's a quid pro quo here. When people are surrendering their privacy in whatever increments, they're also getting benefits. How does the Congress or how do executive branch regulators deal with the privacy issue without killing the goose that lays the golden egg, both for advertisers and for users themselves?
I really think this is just a matter of common sense and that you have to strike a balance. And I think this is a case where Apple didn't strike a balance, and I think they've acknowledged that. And that's why they've agreed to change a number of things that they're doing here. But yes, we have all kinds of great free services on the internet that are made possible because cookies are put on your computer and they can find out what you're interested in. They take your name off it, but they can advertise to you. And that pays for unbelievable services that no one would ever in their right mind want to get rid of. You know, I mean, I Google all the time. So it's just about really finding out what these practices are, why some are kept secret, and whether we need new laws to make sure that there's no abuses.
Well, Senator Franken, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Al Franken is the Democratic senator from Minnesota. Coming up, the latest WikiLeaks release sheds some much-needed light on Guantanamo. This is On the Media.
This episode of On the Media is supported by Stitcher Smart Radio, offering the Stitcher mobile app. With Stitcher's free app for mobile phones, listeners can get the latest episodes of On the Media, NPR, and thousands of other podcasts on demand without downloading or syncing. The free Stitcher Smart Radio mobile app can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or at stitcher.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week in WikiLeaks, more than 750 previously classified documents about Guantanamo. These were mainly risk assessment dossiers on individual prisoners, which WikiLeaks had offered to seven news organizations under an embargo. That means those organizations had to agree not to report on the material until a time and date set by WikiLeaks. But then an unknown leaker outleaked WikiLeaks, passing the files on to a newspaper WikiLeaks deems unfriendly, The New York Times. The Times went to press with the documents early this week, leaving the original leakees scrambling to get their stories out. One such, McClatchy's Miami Herald, where reporter Carol Rosenberg has covered Guantanamo for years. She has misgivings about the files, which she believes create a skewed version of Gitmo reality, especially when viewed out of context of a decade of judicial and intelligence false starts. But even Rosenberg, the most inveterate Guantanamo reporter, gleaned some new insights. Carol, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Bob.
There must have been stuff that you saw that you would have died to get a hold of at any point during your reporting down there. To your way of thinking, what were the big keepers, the disclosures that made you gasp?
We had photos. And you have to remember that reporters down there are working under limitations that do not let you take pictures of detainees that make them identifiable. And suddenly, we have what look like mugshots, booking photos, one after another. As one of my colleagues said, we could make a Facebook. We could go down there and we could know who's who, just like on a college campus. The photos were a very dramatic first thing I spotted about these.
Was there anything in the files that you saw that caught the Pentagon in a lie that was directly in conflict with what had been told you officially by sources at Guantanamo or at DOD?
Well, one thing jumped off the page, and it was a notation in one of the prisoners' charts, as it were, that back in February 2004, he had refused to go to his reservation, and so they had to extract him from his cell twice. Well, for years they had been telling us that reservations, as they called interrogations, were voluntary.
That's a pretty good Pentagon euphemism right there.
The documents are loaded with those kinds of euphemisms. They talk about people on voluntary total fasts. You know what that is. It's a hunger strike. So this entry was a surprise because it had been part of the presentation at Guantanamo, the weekly tour, that interrogations were voluntary and that detainees wanted to go to interrogation because it was a time to get away from the other guys and hang out and offer opinions or engage an interrogator, something different than the mundane routine of the camp. But here is the note on this man's record that he'd been extracted from his cell twice in February 2004 for refusing to go to a reservation. It just jumped off the page.
I want to ask you a little bit about reporter psychology. When you get your hands on an official document, especially in a vacuum of any kind of real documentary material for, you know, a decade, I guess there's a tendency to overvalue it. Do you think that's what's happened here?
I do think that's happened to a certain degree. I mean, I've been building files on these guys, so I take this document and I compare it to what's gone on in federal court, what's gone on in the military commissions, what's gone on in other hearings, what else I know about these men. And this document is just a part of a picture. It's a snapshot in time. It's an argument made by the prison camps that they got the right people based on a mosaic of information that they have patched together to make their best case. We know that since Obama took over, they've updated these documents and they've changed. So this is a snapshot of a moment in time that in some instances is 7 or 8 years ago. So while it looks like the only thing that we know about these men down there, it's not. It's, as they say at Guantanamo, part of the mosaic.
All right, Carol. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carol Rosenberg reports on Guantanamo for the Miami Herald. When AOL spent $315 million to acquire the Huffington Post a month ago, the deal raised many questions. The first one was, $315 million? What? Then came lots of speculation about who won and who lost. But what interested On the Media was what the deal meant to the future of journalism and what now to make of this thing, this phenomenal thing, the Huffington Post. The only way to begin, I'm sorry to say, is with everything about the HuffPo that makes traditional journalists want to puke. Be patient. It isn't a short list. Beginning with, HuffPo is kind of yellow. Not cowardly yellow, sensationalist yellow. As I write this piece, the blaring lead headline is, I kid you not, Time is Running Out. Approaching Meteor? No, just a procedural deadline for federal financial reform rules in 3 months. Last week, they scared the bejeebers out of me with, Texas is burning border to border. The wildfires there did claim 1 million acres, but at least 99.4% of Texas was unconsumed by flames. And the rest of the layout is pretty bombastic as well.
It is a visual presentation that I think might charitably be described as a combination of an old-fashioned afternoon tabloid and a ransom note.
Los Angeles Times media critic Tim Rutan. As a longtime detractor, Rutan is one-stop shopping for HuffPo's shortcomings. Item 2, aggregation. A large percentage of content on the Huffington Post summarizes and links to material from other publications, providing HuffPo for free what others have paid dearly to produce.
Aggregation is the elevation of kleptocracy to a business model. You're simply stealing things that other businesses, other media organizations have paid to gather.
Yes, HuffPo redirects traffic to the source, but those readers usually make a U-turn right back to HuffPo for more of the web highlights HuffPo then sells advertising against. Putting aside whether this digital age fair use is really fair, Rutan says,
people who buy into this notion that information wants to be free, that free information is somehow in the DNA of the web, whatever that means, people who buy into that notion are simply committing themselves to a suicide pact. If that notion prevails in a decade, there won't be any serious journalism to aggregate.
Ah, seriousness. Much of HuffPo's traffic is generated thanks to the right rail, filled with what they call click candy. As I write this, the world's 10 creepiest abandoned cities, Liz Taylor's last husband speaks out, and the amazing pain-killing properties of olive oil. Indeed, the entirety of the Huffington Post is edited with preferences of the reader very much top of mind. Favoring subjects already trending high in online interest is called search engine optimization. Another term might be auto-pandering.
This notion of tailored news is really a form of informational narcissism.
Once again, Tim Rutan.
It allows you to narrow down the scope of your news consumption to those things you already know or believe you know. And what it doesn't do is let you see the story that you never imagined you'd be interested in, and that somehow broadens your perspective, enriches your life, makes you a better citizen, gives you something to think about that afternoon.
None of these is a trifling concern, nor are the remaining controversial HuffPo quirks. It's building up a $315 million asset through the labors of unpaid bloggers, and its pronounced liberal slant, raising questions of journalistic credibility. But let's also consider some other untrifling facts. For one, AOL just paid $333 million to shape all of its content in the image of HuffPo founder-in-chief Arianna Huffington. Why? Because her website draws 38 million unique visitors a month, visitors who don't seem too put off by hyperbolic headlines. AOL expects HuffPo itself to generate $100 million in revenue next year and 30% operating margins. Those are the kinds of numbers newspapers used to generate before they were propelled into a death spiral by the very digital revolution being exploited by websites like HuffPo. Meanwhile, the institution evolves. Arianna has been on a hiring binge, bringing in talented reporters and editors from the New York Times, Newsweek, Rutan's own LA Times, and elsewhere. The newsroom is now at 200 employees on its way, says founding editor Roy Seacoff, to doubling. And while they will never blanket the field with staff reporters, they will report the news that matters the HuffPo way, through live blogs and tweets, camera phone video, and other tools that turn eyewitnesses into citizen journalists. Roy Seacoff.
You know, there's many ways to bear witness. I'm not saying that having seasoned reporters on the ground is not an extraordinarily effective way, and that's great, and I welcome it, and we'll link to it. But I think that there is a bearing witness 2.0. There's other ways of getting stories and finding the truth behind stories.
Not to mention the Web 2.0 way of not letting the published story be the end of the story. Other news organizations grudgingly host audience comments. HuffPo assiduously cultivates the commenter community with social media mechanisms for following and becoming a fan of others in the HuffPo sphere. A column about potential GOP presidential aspirant Rick Santorum Thursday evening generated more than 1,000 comments in 3.5 hours.
Shouldn't news organizations learn a business lesson from that?
Jeff Jarvis, director of the Tone Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the City University of New York.
How to engage an audience and how to create and engage in a conversation that enables people other than just journalists to talk. If people are spending more time on Huffington Post, what's Huffington doing right that they're doing wrong.
Jarvis gets steamed when mainstream journalists sneer at HuffPo, such as when the New York Times' David Carr, upon the release of four Times journalists from armed captors in Libya, mused in a tweet about Ariana trying to, quote, aggregate them back to safety.
I don't think that line works anymore when we look at what Andy Carvin at NPR retweets from Libya and Egypt and Tunisia, where the witnesses to these major stories are also putting themselves in harm's way and losing their lives. You know, virtue is not a business model.
At least these days, not a profitable one. Maybe that's the source of so much journalistic resentment along the lines of icemen gloomily witnessing the advent of refrigeration. HuffPo's Roy Seacoff isn't unsympathetic, but that doesn't stop him from sticking his glass into the crushed ice dispenser of his Viking.
Now, call me a destroyer, but I still would like to get my ice that way as opposed to having the guy haul it up four flights of stairs on his shoulder.
Me, I'm not sure what to make of the HuffPo phenomenon. I guess I'm hoping that it becomes the best of both worlds, a robust news-gathering organization that also exploits the knowledge and labors of a hyper-connected community. So, yeah, I'm hoping for the best, but also prepared to heed the lead headline that a few hours later replaced Time is Running Out. It was about potential flooding in the Deep South. In giant capital letters, it screamed, "Bracing for the worst." As mentioned, the Huffington Post built itself into a multi-million dollar brand in part with unpaid contributors. Oh, there's a value exchange. HuffPo gets content for free, and activists and celebrities and others get a platform for their opinions. No harm, no foul. But when AOL ponied up $315 million for the site, one-time HuffPo blogger Jonathan Tessini thought, hey, we deserve some of that. He filed a $100 million class action lawsuit on behalf of all unpaid contributors like him.
We're arguing two things in court. One is that there was unjust enrichment, which is a legal theory that says that even if you were not specifically promised a certain amount up front, if your work is exploited for economic advantage, you can come back retroactively and demand payment. And the second thing we're arguing is there's a series of deceptive business practices that were conducted by Huffington Post.
To wit?
Essentially, people were promised certain things that were not fulfilled.
But you wrote for HuffPo with the understanding that you would not be paid in cash, that whatever value you derived from being a blogger there was all that you were going to get out of it. So what changed your mind as to what is due you?
I think it's important to say that not only what changed my mind, but what changed the minds of hundreds of other bloggers was the sale to AOL. We created the value, and she basically took a Marie Antoinette approach, which is let them eat cake, we don't care, you're not worth anything, hit the road when people said, why don't you pay a little bit to people? And frankly, I think that it was her greed and her dismissiveness that led to people continuing to organize. Because had she been smart, had she sent everybody a small check, let's say $25 or $50, this would never have reached the crescendo that it has reached.
Perhaps not. But let me tell you what seems the flaw in your argument and the kind of logical flaw in your outrage. You had a deal, and how do you change the terms of the deal ex post facto?
When I filed the lawsuit in 1993 against the New York Times on a copyright violation on behalf of tens of thousands of other writers, everybody says, oh, you're crazy. You're nuts. You're never going to win that. That's crazy. And so we just proceeded with that, and we won in the United States Supreme Court 7-2 in 2001 and set a landmark precedent. The second piece, which is, if you will, moral outrage, I do think it is significant. What got people going was not whether it was zero or a dollar or something. It was Ariana Huffington's greed and hypocrisy. Remember, this is someone who has built her brand out of, I am the one standing up for the middle class, the little guy, and again, CEO greed. And she, in fact, is the greatest representation of CEO greed to the very people who created the value to the company. And so what we're trying to do is both get money for people retroactively, but also trying to set a standard going forward so that bloggers in the future can earn a decent living and our culture can flower, because without people who actually make a living from this, our culture suffers.
But are the courts the place to build a blogger economy?
Well, I think that's a very valuable point. The only way you build power, whether among bloggers or mine workers or anybody, is through unions and through organizing. And that's why I'm deeply involved in this organizing. There is a strike and a boycott at Huffington Post. Anybody who writes for them, any liberal, progressive, elected official or person who comes to the labor movement for money, they are crossing a picket line. They are scabs. They are strike breakers. So that's a whole piece that I'm as excited about the legal case.
Just curious, how much money do you figure AOL owes you now?
Well, the case itself asked for, I believe, $105 million as a starting point. That was a rough calculation using various standards and estimates about how much collectively is owed to all these bloggers. And ultimately, what happens if you win the case, then there has to be some figuring out how to distribute whatever pool of money is awarded to the bloggers.
Let's just say Arianna Huffington is a greedy hypocrite on a grand scale. It's not against the law, at least not any statute law I'm familiar with. In fact, it might even be the American way.
As Goldman Sachs proves every day.
Well, and there you are. So, you know, how do you get remedy for that in federal court?
You are right. Avarice is a part of the American way, partly because of the weakness of unions and the weakness of people to be organized. And the fight in the court is only a small piece of what has to be done. Let's say we win in court. Okay, we get a bunch of money. If there's nobody there to set a standard and keep fighting year after year in the way unions like AFTRA and SAG set standards for creators in the arts going back for 80 years, if you don't have those organizations, you're right. Wins in court don't matter.
Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Jonathan Tessini is president of the Economic Future Group. He blogs at workinglife.org. Coming up, since bots may now outnumber humans online, a primer on how to spot them. This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at RWJF.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Earlier this year, 500 or so Twitterers received tweets from someone with the handle at James M. Titus, who posed one of several generic questions. How long do you want to live to, for example? Or do you have any pets? At James M. Titus was cheerful and enthusiastic, kind of like those people who comment on the weather and then laugh heartily. Perhaps because of that good nature, or perhaps because of his inquiring spirit and interest in others, at James M. Titus was able to strike up a fair number of continuing conversations. Only thing is, there is no James M. Titus. He, or it, is a bot, a software program designed to engage actual humans in social networks. He grew out of a contest to devise a social bot, a contest staged by a group of techies calling themselves the Web Ecology Project. Tim Huang is the director of the Web Ecology Project. He joins us from Berkeley, California. Tim, welcome to On the Media.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Tell me how the contest was designed. You set up a number of teams, and they each had 2 weeks, and were given a list of Twitter accounts to send robotic messages to?
We thought about it. It was sort of like social battle bots. We put together a list of 500 very active Twitter users. And the way we did that is we pulled 100 people who really love talking about cats online because, you know, cats run the internet. And we pulled some of their friends randomly and some of their friends randomly to generate kind of a semi-connected network of people. And then the teams were said, okay, here's the boundaries of this competition. Design a bot and we'll drop these bots into the network and see how they do. And then the scoring was, the bot got a point for every mutual connection it created. You know, it follows someone, someone follows it. And 3 points for every at reply, retweet, you know, conversation piece they're able to generate.
Now, this was an experiment about Twitter bots, but what is the bot presence online in things apart from Twitter?
Bots are everywhere online. Some might actually argue that there's more bots online than there are humans online. There's a huge number of bots that generate spam email. And certainly on social platforms, bots generate a huge amount of content. They're mostly in the business of trying to get a message in front of as many people as possible. What's rarer online and what our social bots are trying to do is focus on a much slower and deeper type of connection with people. They're interested in affecting the way people talk to it and talk to one another.
What was it about James M. Titus that enabled him to beat the other contestants?
James M. Titus was designed actually not to be shy at all. He would talk all day, all night to all sorts of different people. And I think most of the teams assumed that that would automatically be detected as an automated identity, right? And people would just ignore it. But it turns out the opposite is the case, actually. When you talk a lot, it turns out that people want to talk to you more, and you're also perceived as more human. One of the really interesting things that happened during the competition was a team launched a counteroffensive against James M. Titus, and the counteroffensive was a bot called Bot Cops. And bot cops would basically go after James's followers and say, you may want to be aware, we're detecting that James is a bot, don't listen to him. And people were asking, oh, James, are you a bot? Are you a bot? And James actually said, well, oh, I don't know, what do you think? Or, you know, oh, that's so funny. And actually, in responding right off the bat to some of these people, they basically just assumed that there was a human behind the computer on the other side, and you actually had people back off.
You mean because his answers were non-responsive, kind of non-sequiturs, people assumed that it was a live human being? Wow, that doesn't speak too well for, you know,
the humans.
Humanity.
It's true. It's true. And these conversations actually end up being quite human-like, precisely because they are sort of so random and non sequitur in some ways. One really funny incident that we had was he was asking one of his followers, you know, what was a famous character from a book that you really liked? And someone said Jesus. And his response was, you know, right on, bro.
All right. So what is the practical application of creating a Twitter bot or any kind of social bot? How can it be used for good and how can it be used for evil?
You know, these bots are cheap to run. They're almost free to run. So what if we were to launch a whole swarm of them to change the way people connect on a very large scale, right? 10,000, 100,000 people. Maybe these bots can act as a kind of social scaffolding, right? They bring communities together and then the bots sort of deactivate, right? And so what you are left with is an actual community of people. And we could say, let's bring together all the people who are civically engaged or they want to help out and promote charities, for instance. And often these communities are quite balkanized. And what these bots can do online is help to bridge that gap between various communities. Now, in addition to building connections, one of the worries, of course, is that the bots might be used to destroy connections or to disrupt emergent processes happening online, right? You can think of the Iran election or the Twitter interactions around the Syrian protests. And there's been some indication that bots are actually already in the mix, attempting to disrupt or support various sides of, you know, that particular protest. And so I think there's a number of good uses and bad uses. I think ultimately what these bots do is they're kind of a tool for social architecting, for better or for worse.
What would happen if a bot tweeted a bot? Armageddon, the world's most disjointed conversation, what?
One of the things that definitely interests me is kind of all the things that happen when bots run into bots randomly online. There's a really interesting story that popped up last week where they discovered online that there was a $23,830,000 book, a used book being sold on Amazon. And the reason that the book's price had gotten to that point was that there were two bots battling it out. And it actually turned out that the bot strategy was always to outbid the other bot, right? And the two of them were just interacting together until you had this used book that was like $24 million. And I think social bots, right, they in some ways could have this endless conversation with one another when they run into each other. You can even imagine, right, in the future, clusters of bots on social platforms online, which is just bots talking to other bots.
How do things like Twitter bots force us to change our behavior, change our understanding of the net? How does it just change our lives?
The fact that social interactions happen on a digital platform now means that software, in some sense, is something that will likely be able to interact with us in the way that we normally associate with just interacting with humans, you know, in a day-to-day, non-online basis. And so I think one of the things maybe it presages and suggests is, you know, in the future, maybe people will have to just be a lot more aware that the interactions that they're seeing online, the type of social phenomena, the trends that they're seeing online could be human or they could be synthetic or an odd hybrid of both. I think the big initial thing that comes to mind, right, is this need to sort of be more skeptical about some of the processes that we see online. You know, the mainstream media now especially uses Twitter as such a proxy for what people think in the universe as a whole. In manipulating some of these processes, you could actually imagine that you'd actually be able to manipulate the news cycle.
Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Tim Wong is the director of the Web Ecology Project in Berkeley, California. On Wednesday, President Barack Obama held a White House press conference, not about the economy, not about education or health care, not about the increasing U.S. role in various parts of the Middle East. He held a press conference to release his long-form birth certificate. The president gently mocked the major networks for interrupting their regular programming to cover the conference.
Let me just comment, first of all, on the fact that I can't get the networks to break in on all kinds of other discussions.
The birther conspiracy had again become a mainstream news item as potential Republican candidate Donald Trump continually raised it in interviews and stump speeches.
He's got a certificate of live birth. That's, by the way, despite what certain liberal press says, that's not a birth certificate.
All I want to do is see this guy's birth certificate. Why doesn't he show his birth certificate? And you know what? I wish he would, because I think it's a terrible pall that's hanging over him.
Ironically, before the birth certificate was released, Trump said it was the media, not him, that was making the big deal out of the issue. And even after its release, he continued to blame the media. Here he is with CNN's John King.
You raised this, saying the president should release
this. No, you raised
this. As a question. No, I did not raise this. I didn't call a press conference in Palm Beach earlier this week. I haven't been on all these television shows.
And every time I sit down with the press, all they want to talk about is the birth certificate.
Just as with the release of the short-form birth certificate by the Obama campaign in 2008, this wasn't enough to stop the insanity, as birther suspicions now turned to forgery. James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. He says irrational political discourse is nothing new in our country's history, and like conspiracy theories before it, this one is not likely to go away. Jim, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you very much, Bob.
It was as if the President of the United States had convened the press to put to rest once and for all the rumor that Mikey, the kid from the Life cereal ads, had died eating Pop Rocks. It was kind of surreal. How did we get here?
There is something that is constant in American political life, which we're seeing the current, you know, incarnation of, and something that actually is different in the shift of the media. I think what is constant is the suspiciousness and suspicions of whoever holds positions of power. I mean, I remember when I was a kid, the rumors in my right-wing hometown about what John F. Kennedy was doing to conspire with the Pope, and then some even more dire rumors about Lyndon Johnson after Kennedy's death. And through American history, there have always been these thoughts about whoever is in control. What's different now, I think, is the ability of these thoughts to get a more mainstream hearing than was the case before. You know, when Kennedy or Johnson were being the subject of rumors 40 or 50 years ago, there was Walter Cronkite, and there were the editors of Time and Life, and there was the New York Times, just to say, this is not something we're going to go into. And now, with the mixed blessings of a more open media ecology, this is what we have.
The president spoke for about 5 minutes, devoting most of that time to ridiculing or upbraiding the press for putting him in the position to even address the subject. Does the press deserve the blame for keeping this rumor top of mind? Or when someone like Donald Trump makes it a campaign issue, is the press simply obliged to report what he's saying?
The strongest case you could make for the press having blown this out of proportion would be the following two elements. One is having reported it over the last couple of years as something where reasonable people can disagree. There are people who say the world is round. There are people who say the earth is flat. And there's been this presentation of it as if it were a seriously contested issue. The other is the current treatment of Donald Trump. I submit that every single member of the political press corps knows that Donald Trump is not going to be the next president of the United States. And so there has been a sort of willing participation in the carnival Barkerism to just televise the spectacle of Trump making these claims.
But again, you say nothing new here. 'Twas ever thus. You mentioned John F. Kennedy and the Pope. You alluded to rumors that Lyndon Johnson had been behind the Kennedy assassination. But preposterous rumors about the president go back well before that. Can you give me some examples?
In a way, you could say that birtherism now takes America back to its roots. And I think many people are familiar with all the editorial cartoons of the anti-Lincoln movement during the 1860 election and even after he became president, alleging more or less seriously that he was in fact a gorilla, not a human being. And when Andrew Jackson was in the White House, the partisan press then was talking about his own loose morals and those of his wife, which apparently drove his wife to a mental breakdown. One of my favorites of these was when Herbert Hoover was president in the late 1920s, there was a whole line of argument that, number one, he was a British subject, and number two, that he had imported Chinese coolie slaves to the White House from his time when he was working as an engineer in China. So you could say that the mainstreaming of this kind of birther complaint sort of skips over the era of mainstream conventional news of the early 20th century and takes us back to our 18th and 19th century partisan press roots.
What's little known about Hoover, though, oddly, is that he was, in fact, 20% gorilla. For rumors like this to take hold, it takes a certain willing suspension of disbelief on the part of the public. It's hard for me to get, once a fact has been demonstrated, for example, the president's Hawaii birth, how the rumors can stay alive. What is it about the American body politic that makes it so intermittently irrational?
When it comes to political views, actual logic does not really change many people's views, at least in the short term. That if you look at the way political elections are carried out and the way people make up their minds on large issues, it's partly logic, but it's also what you could think of as tribalism, it's loyalties to what the people you like think. And so it is this emotional appeal, the music of political life, discordant as it may sometimes be.
I got to tell you, Jim, I was loath to do this segment on the grounds of giving more airing to ridiculous rumor embraced by a fringe of American political life. But in the last poll, approximately half of registered Republican voters believed that the president was not born in the United States. And we had already long since seen proof that the rumor was false. So what happens next? What's your best guess for whether this simply creates another wrinkle in the conspiracy, probably involving forgery, I guess?
You cannot rationally believe anymore that Barack Obama was born in Kenya or someplace outside the United States, but many people, I suspect, still will believe that. So I guess the main thing I can hope is that such mainstream media as we have will be shamed out of further coverage of what Donald Trump or whoever follows him might claim on this point. The underlying fact that there is a lot of resistance among some part of our population to the idea of Obama's background, i.e. the first non-white president occupying the White House, I think there's going to be resistance to that and it affects his time in office. Mainly we can hope that most of the media will behave differently about this issue from this time on.
Yeah, well, don't wish your life away. Jim, thanks, as always.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic.
We're not going to be able to solve our problems if we get distracted by sideshows and carnival barkers.
There the president was, live on national TV, to produce his original birth certificate. The networks had broken into regular programming for the latest debunking of the birther lunacy, which was like breaking in to report on the debunking of alchemy. Quite the conspiracy, this birther caper, which imagines the uncanny prescience and criminality of the extended Obama family, Kapi'olani Hospital, the local newspaper, the state of Hawaii, and a clairvoyant newborn. If baby Barack's future had been so magically foretold by such neonatal ministrations, he wouldn't be the president of the United States. He'd be Jesus. So why do the mainstream media take the bait from the Donald Trumps of the world? Why do they add oxygen to the fires of political cynicism and stupidity? If they simply ignored this nonsense, wouldn't the story just flicker out once and for all? Well, first of all, no, it wouldn't. In the internet world and the Fox News Channel world, the mainstream media aren't the arbiters of what stories live or die. But beyond that, notwithstanding the president's digs at the press corps, the media have nothing here to be ashamed of. They didn't seize on the birther story because they regarded it as unsettled. They did so mainly to foster evaluation of supposed presidential hopeful Donald Trump and of elected officials who keep doubt alive by framing the president's birth as a matter of belief, not of fact. When Speaker of the House John Boehner says, "I take the president at his word," that slyly leaves open the possibility that the president is lying. So Obama shouldn't be ridiculing the messenger here. If anything, the president owes the press a debt of gratitude. If he wants the public to distinguish a responsible leader from a carnival barker, someone has to document the barking. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sarah Abdurrahman. And this week, our show was edited by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe. Ellen Horn is WNYC's Senior Director of National Programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.